Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In the market for a new car? Ready to replace that Toyota Camry and you're worried about news that Toyota has more complaints involving crashes than any other car maker? Detroit has a question for you. Have you driven a Ford sales went up 43% last month while Toyota's fell. In fact, sales for all automakers went up in January, except Toyota. At the moment, Honda, Nissan, GM, and other car makers may be getting a boost from Toyota's bad press. But then again, maybe there are simply more cars driving off all lots, except Toyota's. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 3rd. And The Takeaway for me, John, you know, we've been talking a lot about numbers this week. My advice and my takeaway is don't be in a rush to interpret these numbers and attach too much meaning to them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of loyalty for a Toyota.
There is.
And they're going to be relying on that over the next several weeks, that's for sure. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. It's a last-ditch attempt to craft a bipartisan health care reform bill. President Obama will release a new proposal today that will include some Republican ideas. Already, though, Republicans are saying it's not enough, as Senator Judd Gregg tells The Takeaway.
Everybody should have problems with that bill because it's such an atrocity. It's like a giant asteroid headed at the Earth.
Giant asteroid headed towards the Earth. Not exaggerating at all. If Republicans remain dug in, the president is expected to urge Democrats today to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rules vote. The Senate was able to agree long enough to pass an extension of jobless benefits last night. It's been held up by Senator Jim Bunning. President Obama has already signed that bill.
In Chile, 4 days after the country was hit by its strongest earthquake in 50 years, the death toll now stands at nearly 800, and many residents are upset with the government's slow response time. In the hard-hit city of Concepcion, we spoke earlier to BBC correspondent Valeria Parazo.
There are lots of people camping on the streets, people who have either lost their houses or decided to leave and stay in open spaces.
She says the military has a strong presence on the streets and people are reassured by that.
In Iraq, three suicide bombings in the city of Bakuba have killed at least 30 people. In the past 15 minutes, our partner, the BBC, told us there will be 200,000 Iraqi security forces on the streets of Baghdad for this week's elections. And in Texas primary elections, the governor, Rick Perry, has defeated Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson in that Republican gubernatorial primary. Perry took 51% of the vote, avoiding a runoff. He'll face former Houston Mayor Bill White in November.
More now on Ford's big months. For the first time in nearly a dozen years, the automaker posted better sales numbers than General Motors. They've posted better sales numbers than just about anyone. We're joined now by Nick Bunkley, who is an auto industry reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Nick, is this a sign of Toyota's fall from grace, or is this just a sign of Ford's strengthening brand, do you think?
Well, it's a little bit of both, actually. One reason that these recalls are such big news is because Toyota had just become sort of an automatic choice for so many shoppers, and this is now causing at least some of them to just take a look at what else is out there. And for years, the Detroit companies had been working to get their quality up there, and a lot of studies show that they have, but they just couldn't get a lot of people to even take a look, and this is finally creating that opportunity.
It's causing people to think twice, which the Detroit has been trying to get them to do for a long time, right? Nick Bunkley is with the New York Times. We're going to talk with him more in just a moment. Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are mixed. The Dow will start at 10,405, the S&P at 1,118, and the NASDAQ opens at 2280.
Here's our invitation for you. Coming up, our partner, the BBC, is hosting a competition to have people show off My World to the rest of the globe. If you were going to send a message, a video message, or any kind of message about you and your community to the rest of the world, what would it be? You can take part by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about the BBC's project, but your message to the world on The Takeaway this morning. Coming up, we're talking about that American auto industry. Is Toyota's loss Detroit's gain? Nick Bunkley's on the case in a few minutes.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
February was actually a very good month for automakers. Pretty much across the board, everybody was selling more cars, with one notable exception. In the midst of millions of recalled vehicles, congressional hearings, Toyota sales dropped 9%. Ford sales shot up 43% in the same month. That makes Ford the country's top-selling automaker. And are these just a blip on Toyota's radar screen? Could they signal a permanent change in loyalty toward Toyota among American car customers? That's the question we're asking Nick Bunkley. He's the auto industry reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And Nick, I have to wonder, the Toyota sales dropped 9%. To a certain extent, that's not bad news because analysts had predicted it was going to drop by double digits.
Yeah, they actually did a little bit better than a lot of people were expecting, and even Toyota said it was better than they were expecting because they were so focused for the month on fixing past customers' cars and said they really weren't having their dealers focus on getting new people into the showrooms and selling them cars.
And to be fair, Toyota stopped selling those vehicles for a while, which had to affect sales as well.
Yes, some of those vehicles were unable to be sold until they were fixed, and Toyota says that virtually all of them have been fixed, so basically their whole inventory is available now, and they are entering March, they say, back in sales mode again.
Okay, so I have to ask you, we're asking about whether or not this is a permanent thing or just a kind of a blip on the radar screen, and there's a couple data points here. Number one, Ford Motor Company says they don't think that they're getting increased sales from Toyota's customers. They feel like Toyota's customers are kind of just not buying right now, and Ford is picking up new customers. That's one thing. And the other thing was this new poll conducted at the end of February by Gallup that says most Toyota owners still like their cars, and 82% feel they're still safe.
Ford, the increase that they saw yesterday is really not fully explained by just Toyota people going to Ford instead. I mean, the increase was a lot more than that. And Toyota seems to think that they aren't losing their past customers in very large numbers, but that maybe they are having a hard time right now attracting some new buyers into the brand. That people that haven't bought a Toyota before are thinking, why would I want to buy a Toyota right now? So they're either not buying something or they're buying maybe a Ford or a GM product.
Well, if you want to talk about brands and brand loyalty, we need to bring in Bill McEwen. He's the senior strategic consultant at Gallup, and he's also author of the book Married to the Brand, Why Consumers Bond with Some Brands for Life. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So I want to repeat these statistics from Gallup, from your company, that shows that more than 70% of Toyota owners say they still have confidence in Toyota vehicles, and something like over 80% still feel like they're safe. That's brand loyalty to me.
Well, it's certainly potential loyalty. I think it's important to bear in mind that loyalty is a behavior, but it's a behavior that's accompanied by a strong emotional bond. Anything that weakens that bond is obviously of concern. On one hand, if you have 80% of your current owners saying that they have confidence in you, that's terrific. But you don't want 20% of them to lack that high bond of confidence.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, let me ask you this question that I asked to Nick, which is about explaining this jump in sales on Ford's part. And we're focusing on Ford, but really Nissan, Honda, GM, Hyundai, even Chrysler all saw a jump in sales last month. But let's talk about Ford. Is Ford's brand strengthening, or do you think that they're picking up something from the tarnishing of Toyota's brand?
Well, I think the gap between Ford and indeed between Detroit and Japan with regard to reliability, confidence in the basic promise of an automobile has narrowed. I think that that Ford is now reaping some of the benefits of being in a consideration set that they weren't before.
There's been a lot, Bill, I have to ask you, because for years, Detroit automakers have argued that while their quality has steadily improved, they haven't been able to get that message across to the customers. Do you think the recall, Toyota's recalls, have helped them communicate the message about improving quality coming out of Detroit?
Again, I think what that has done is narrow the gap. I think at one point, the perception was that a lot of Detroit cars were poorly made. As you say, the reality was that they were much better made than they were perceived to be. To the extent that Japanese vehicles led by Toyota are undergoing the same kind of recalls that consumers associated with Detroit vehicles, means that Detroit is not alone in having problems and having to rectify them.
Nick Bunkley, you know, your colleague Marcus Mabry on this program on Monday suggested that when the auto sales came out, the Toyota's losses might be Korean gains. But I was listening to Korean dealers around the country last night talking about how worried they are that if Toyota has a reputation problem, that it's going to affect them, that their fortunes actually lie with Toyota. They don't gain anything. Did you notice that?
Well, the Korean companies, Hyundai and Kia, they certainly have gotten some gains as well. They also had a really good year a year ago, which affects their numbers now. But there is certainly the concern out there that among a lot of foreign automakers that this could spread, and people think that all foreign cars maybe are something to question the quality of. I don't know that that's something we're going to see a whole lot of, especially as the time passes here and the recalls aren't in the top of the news every day.
That's Nick Buckley with the New York Times. Bill McEwen, let me ask you, one analyst that I was listening to said that the other automakers are smart not to make too much out of the Toyota recalls because recalls happen all the time, and they don't want customers feeling like just because you have a recall, it means your quality is suffering. Would you agree that that's a kind of a good brand strategy, not to blow recalls out of proportion?
I would absolutely, because it's the throwing stones at glass houses problem.
Well, which is...
You'll have a glass house yourself at some point.
Right, and Nissan has actually announced today the recall of over 500,000 vehicles. We had a recall from GM and another from Ford within the past couple of weeks as well. So I assume everyone doesn't want to turn recalls into kind of a witch hunt. Bill McEwen is a senior strategic consultant at Gallup. He's author of the book Married to the Brand, Why Consumers Bond with Some Brands for Life. And Nick Bunkley is the auto industry reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks to both of you. And now let's check in on other top stories at 15 minutes past the hour.
Well, first, let's recap those auto sales figures. We're getting news this morning that the Japanese company Nissan has become the latest motor manufacturer to issue a recall of faulty vehicles. It's calling in more than 500,000 pickup trucks and four-wheel drives, mostly in the U.S., because of brake pedal defects. Nissan said no accidents had been reported in connection with the faults. This comes after auto sales show a steep decline in Toyota sales and a steep increase in sales of Ford cars in the U.S. In Chile, plane loads of international aid have begun arriving. Thousands of troops are on the streets helping with distribution of food and water. The government of Chile says 800 people are now known to have been killed by Saturday's quake. Meanwhile, in the country's second largest city, Concepcion, the process of identifying bodies is underway. Forensic police officer Carolina Flores spoke to our partner, the BBC, outside a collapsed apartment building.
We're working in a dead body identification team alongside the firemen. Their rescue teams are going into this building, removing the bodies, and then we use our resources to identify who it is.
In Iraq, three suicide bombs in Bakuba have killed at least 30 people. The U.S. and Iraq have warned such attacks will possibly proliferate leading up to Sunday's parliamentary elections.
Back at home, he's including their ideas but not winning their support. Republicans say they have no plans to support health care legislation, even though the president is including some of their suggestions in his revised bill. He'll make that public this afternoon. And Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison will have to shelve her dreams of becoming governor, at least for now. She was easily beaten in a Republican primary by current Governor Rick Perry. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, how's your credit? Is it good enough to get you a job?
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And it's a full house here at the news takeout window here in the studio. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here, our sports contributor.
Good morning.
Louise Story, finance reporter for the New York Times. We've got an all-employment news takeout segment this morning. We'll begin with you, Louise. This is about the most infuriating thing that I can imagine. There's a new trend spreading among employers using credit checks as a condition or a criteria for deciding whether to employ someone or not.
That's right. So, you know, surveys show that more than half of employers run a credit check on you before they hire you. Their argument is they want to know as much as possible as they can know. And for instance, some have found that if you've lived beyond your means, that's an indication that you're more likely than someone else to, for instance, commit fraud. So they're running
these. Or just have bad judgment.
So they're running these. Now, there's really what's new here is there's a push from 16 different states to make this illegal. This includes South Carolina and Oregon. It's already illegal in Hawaii and Washington. The issue is, you know, will you start a self-fulfilling cycle here? You know, someone has had some debt problems. Maybe they had medical bills for their children or something, and they're trying to get a job to help pay back their bills, but then they can't get a job because you find out they have, you know, had debt. And so they don't get a job, so their debt mounts, and it can be really self-fulfilling. And what's really important now is that we're in a period where more people than ever are facing debt problems, in particular because of our housing and mortgage problem. You know, I was talking with a young couple last week who's facing foreclosure, and it was interesting. I asked them, what do you want the government to do for you? The number one thing they said is, please, we hope they'll figure out some way to remove the taint from credit reports so that we, in a few years, when we get our finances together, can buy again. And so we're not judged, you know, that they're 30 years old, so we're not judged our whole life over this.
You know, the irony here is that banks didn't pay much attention to these credit reports when they were lending like crazy, you know, 5 years ago. But all of a sudden, now they're paying a lot of attention
and
hiring.
Credit is a lot tighter. That's right. Even the banks are paying more attention now.
It's amazing. But first of all, do employers have to disclose that they're doing this if
you're
applying for a job?
They must ask your permission. The problem is most job candidates don't feel comfortable saying no because they want the job, so they say okay. And think about it, if you're the employer and someone says no, then you might just assume that it's bad if they're saying no. So the fact that they can ask and they can do it puts a lot of employees in the position to just say yes, go ahead.
But you're most likely to have bad credit when you're unemployed. I mean, that's the silly
that's
thing.
That's the cycle. It's the self-fulfilling cycle with these credit reports and looking for jobs when you're
unemployed. Debt. People need not apply. That's horrible. That's the new America. Louise Story, a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And Ibrahim?
Yeah, we're talking, as you said, John, we're talking about employment today and talk about the ultimate job application here, the NFL Scouting Combine. I understand it's formally known as the National Invitational Camp. So, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, what is the scouting combine?
It's essentially a job fair for the NFL. So if you want to get a job in the NFL, you want to be a running back, a wide receiver, a quarterback, a defensive end. If you want to play in the NFL, this is your chance and your opportunity to show that in terms of your speed, your quickness, your vertical jump, your broad jump, that the basics of your agility, what your stock will be in the NFL draft that's coming up.
So this is different than the draft, or?
This is different than the draft. This is a pre-draft sort of data crunch. So you get to see, so people that are deciding who's going to fit in the draft and which position they're going to go, then NFL coaches can say, this is where I want this guy, this is where I want that guy, based on all these statistics that come out of this combine.
Right, and they put them through both physical tests and mental tests. So
Correct.
Give me an example of the kind of test they have to do.
So, for example, you're going to do a vertical jump, a vertical jump, you know, to see how high you can jump, a broad jump, the bench press, and it's not like how much you can bench, it's how much you can bench the most amount of time. So, endurance, exactly. Yeah. And it shows your durability. And then also the 40-yard dash. That's probably the biggest one. For example, C.J. Spiller, who's the top running back prospect right now, he comes out of Clemson, he ran a 4.37 in the 40-yard dash. I'm not sure how fast you guys can all run the 40.
I can't.
But that's
run
pretty,
it that.
That's pretty that. Fast.
And how much does he weigh?
He's 196 pounds, almost 200
so
pounds.
On the light side.
Yeah, so exactly.
But some of those 200
and just give you a sense also about the draft. Last year, there were two players that were sort of kind of not below the radar a little bit, and they bumped up their stock in the draft. For example, Mark Sanchez out of USC. He hadn't played a lot of games in college, so they didn't see a lot of them. But then in the draft, he said they he
in
showed
the combine,
in the combine, exactly. He proved that he was you know, that he was NFL material, and also Sean Green, who became a running back for the Jets, who performed extremely well in the playoffs. In the combine, he improved his draft stock incredibly.
So who's doing well at the combine this year?
This year you have C.J. Spiller is the guy. He's the running back guy that everyone's talking about. Running backs and wide receivers are doing exceptionally well. Defensive ends are usually doing, and linebackers are usually do well because their positions translate well to the NFL. So, you know, a quarterback may or may not have what the skills or what it takes based on the system that they came from in college, but the running backs and the defensive players, their skill set really translates well, so they're doing pretty well.
Do agents love this? I mean, do agents say, go do this, or do agents want people to stay back and maybe conceal some of this stuff?
We were just talking about this. If you're a top prospect going into the combine,
right. You
probably want to go to the combine because there might be other people from conferences that may not have gotten as much TV exposure that are going to go and perform extremely well and might bump you out of your draft position.
So give me an example of a mental test. I read that they put them through these mental tests. What are they doing, grilling them on the rules?
Well, they're simple tests, and actually we were just talking about that. It seems a little sad that so many people don't do that well on the mental test, which proves that sometimes there's a social promotion that happens. They get pushed along in college and not really tested very hard. So the mental tests aren't very rigorous. They're just – I think it's just a general aptitude and general understanding.
Okay.
So like, what's your favorite color? Stuff like that.
So blue. Yellow.
The one interesting thing about the draft this year is that the NFL running backs have been sort of offloaded. Like the premier running backs like Brian Westbrook, LaDainian Tomlinson for the San Diego. And so they're looking to the draft to bring in this NFL youth movement.
Okay. With Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, talking about the NFL scouting combine. It ended yesterday, and now we're looking ahead to the draft. Draft order, St. Louis Rams get the first pick.
And Detroit Lions, number two.
Number two. I wonder why.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. You've heard that expression. Last year, Las Vegas was the only American city continuing to spiral into depression. We're trying to measure the adversity index. In just a few moments, we'll go to the Las Vegas community and some other communities around America to measure the economic headwinds. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at about 31 minutes after the hour. President Obama expected to lay out his final plan for health care reform today. It's expected to include a few Republican proposals, although it's unlikely to win any support across the aisle. The president is also expected to urge Democrats to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rules vote. North Carolina school system has voted to assigning students to schools by race and socioeconomic background. The Wake County School Board, which includes Raleigh, adopted the plan 10 years ago, but it's grown unpopular with some parents. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dave DeWitt, education reporter at North Carolina Public Radio.
Folks who disagreed with the policy cited that the high dropout rate, 54% graduation rate of low-income students, was proof that the policy wasn't working in the first place.
The change still needs final approval later this month.
In Chile, the death toll now stands at nearly 800 and likely to rise in the coming days as search and rescue crews dig into collapsed buildings. Earlier in The Takeaway, we asked State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley what the U.S. is sending in terms of aid.
The things that they're looking at, bridges have been affected, so they're looking for portable bridges. You know, absence of water and electricity, so generators, water purification equipment, a field hospital.
There are no plans to send U.S. troops to the region. Somali pirates have hijacked a Saudi tanker with 14 crew on board. A European Union spokesman says the tanker usually carried fuel, but it was empty when it was taken earlier this week. Somali pirates are currently holding 6 hijacked ships and 132 sailors. And here at home, the FAA is investigating air traffic controllers who apparently let a child direct planes at New York's JFK Airport. CBS News played the recording early this morning.
AMAX 403, contact departure, adios.
Contact departure, Aeromexico 403, adios.
child's age is unclear, but the kid made at least 5 radio transmissions to commercial pilots who are waiting to take off. Let's check on the markets now. Asian markets are mixed. European indices down. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,405, the S&P at 1,118, and the NASDAQ starts at 2280. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
We refer to indices a lot when we talk about market activity. It's an attempt to combine numbers and show what's actually going on in a complicated system like the stock market. We do that in the broad economy as well. The Moody's consulting firm and rating firm has something called the Adversity Index. Moody'sEconomy.com and MSNBC.com have wrapped it up in a neat package that shows where in communities around the country the recession is continuing, getting better, getting worse. And out of 381 metro areas measured by the Moody's Economy.com Adversity Index, Las Vegas is the only metropolitan area still spiraling further into recession at the end of 2009. Ian Milchrist is the executive producer of State of Nevada on member station KNPR. Ian, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. I guess that includes the depression, huh?
It's really stuck in depression right now. There's the usual kind of indexes: unemployment, home prices, the visitation of the tourist industry, all those kind of things continuing to slide in Las Vegas.
Now, as you attempt to turn those numbers into voices and news stories there at KNPR, you know, what do you encounter? Who do you talk to? And how do you get a sense that this adversity index is actually accurate?
Well, I mean, for the last 18 months or so, it's been construction and the tourism industry, which is really depressed. Hotel workers who used to be able to get 50 hours of work are now totally unemployed. And we're now into a kind of second cycle where government services are being depleted. We've just finished a special session where a bit of extra revenue was shaken out of the budget, and an $887 million budget hole had to be closed. And that probably means we're going to see, cuts, furloughs, and cities across the state are struggling to try and reopen contracts and either lay off people or cut government worker wages, and we probably will see teacher layoffs as well.
We're going to hear her voice in a moment, but tell me a little bit about Julie Murray, someone you encountered in your reporting.
Well, she's the head of the largest food bank organization in Las Vegas, and she says that the recession has made the hunger problem much, much worse. It used to be just people who had underemployment problems and who had social problems. Now she says well-meaning middle-class people are also facing what the sociologists call food insecurity.
Well, let's listen to a food bank organizer, Julie Murray, turn an adversity number into something starkly human. Listen.
I was filling up gasoline near my home, and as I was getting gas, a father pulled into the gas station in a white four-door car with his two little girls and hung his head low and came over to me and said, I have no money for gas. I have no money for food. Can you help? And that gentleman, you could tell, was the typical example of the middle-class family who've never before accessed food.
It's Julie Murray, the head of Three Square, an organization that provides meals to the poor in Las Vegas. Boy, there is a stark example, Ian Milchrist, of economic headwinds right there in your community of Las Vegas. Hold on for a moment, because we have Gail Banzit with us. She's a reporter for member station KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, John.
Now, you have a more complicated problem because within Oklahoma, there are very different sort of senses of adversity in the communities that you're reporting on. Explain what you've come up with.
Well, that's right. You know, we're a lot different from Las Vegas in that we're not exactly a big touristy state. You come to Oklahoma to simply live and work in Oklahoma. So while our housing numbers remain strong and we didn't see that huge housing bust that a lot of other states saw, we are an energy state where our revenue is based off of oil and natural gas sales tax revenue. So we're not completely immune to the recession, but Oklahoma is known to follow trends late and kind of be slow to follow those trends. So we entered the recession about 2 quarters later than the rest of the nation.
Now, in terms of this adversity index, adversity has certainly affected the immigration rates in your state. How has that worked?
Well, the immigration rates, as far as I know, haven't really been an issue with everything going on as far as the recession, our housing markets, our economy as of right now. You know, a lot of those jobs in Tulsa and Oklahoma City were held by the same group of people before, so that's not really an issue at this point.
Although, aren't you seeing a sense of negative population growth in the sense that the people aren't coming to the state in the way that they used to?
Well, Oklahoma is just like any other state in that some small core businesses known in communities around the state for those certain industries and jobs, you know, have had to let people go in the past year or so. But we haven't, our unemployment numbers are a lot lower compared to other states.
Let's listen to the confidence of Doug Emdy, who's the president of the Oklahoma Association of Realtors. And I want to ask you about this, Gail. Listen.
We think our economy is not going to crater or fall apart. And as long as people have their jobs and continue to have their jobs, I don't think you'll see a large increase in foreclosures in Oklahoma.
You mentioned, Gail Benzett, that energy is something of an insurance policy for the state of Oklahoma. Has it worked out that way in Oklahoma City or Tulsa or Lawton?
Has that been an issue in Oklahoma City or Tulsa or Lawton?
Has energy been an insurance policy that's insulated these communities?
Some, but we based our projections a little high for the year, so we're kind of feeling those effects. But as things continue to go back up, we'll get back on track.
Generally, Gail, is the trend up or down in Oklahoma?
Right now, slowly becoming back up.
In Millcrest in Las Vegas, up or down?
Totally down.
Totally down. Headwinds in Las Vegas and marginal improvements there in Oklahoma. Gail Benzett is a reporter from member station KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Ian Millcrest is executive producer of State of Nevada on KNPR. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
As of today, same-sex couples can legally apply for marriage licenses in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty signed the Religious Freedom and Civil Marriage Equality Act into law in December. He had very little opposition in the D.C. council vote. It passed by a vote of 11-2. But beyond hot topic gender issues, my next guest says gay rights activists have a huge racial hurdle to get over in order to really see the benefits of this legislative victory. The city of Washington, D.C. has a population of about 600,000. That's largely made up of African Americans, and that's a voting bloc that in the past has voted against rights for same-sex marriage. Michael Crawford is the director of New Media for Freedom to Marry, and he's been fighting for gay marriage rights for years now. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Black voters in California, they say, voted to ban same-sex marriage by a ratio of about 2-1. We got very comparable numbers when the vote came up in Florida. Do you dispute these numbers, or do you accept the fact that there's an opposition among the black community to same-sex marriage rights?
Well, I do dispute the numbers that came out of exit polling in Prop 8, which claimed that 70% of African Americans voted for Prop 8. What they found was that when they did a more comprehensive study of voters in California around Prop 8, was that once you factored out the number of times per week that a person attended religious services, African Americans didn't. There was very little difference between how African Americans voted and how other racial groups voted on Prop 8. And it's also helpful to point out that because of the size of the African-American population in California, the African-American vote could not have swung Prop 8 either way.
But so you're saying that this is a religious thing. Churchgoers vote against same-sex marriage rights, not blacks.
Yes, and it just also happens that some African Americans attend religious services more often than other ethnic groups. But what we've seen consistently across the country is that religious attendance is more a predictor of voting against equality for same-sex couples than is race or ethnicity.
But you know, whatever the reason for it, that still means that black populations are very often likely to vote against marriage rights for gays, and then that's a problem for you.
As we saw in D.C., there if we do strong outreach to African-American communities, we can have support from African-Americans for marriage for same-sex couples. I'm African-American myself. Among the leadership of other folks who work for marriage equality in D.C. were a range of African-American folks, both straight and gay. One of the things that has not been picked up as much as we'd like is the fact that there were a range of clergy leaders who came out in support of marriage for same-sex couples as well, including a lot of clergy leaders who are African-American and have churches that are in predominantly African-American neighborhoods in D.C.
But this must be a big day for you, Michael Crawford.
Yes, it's an amazing day. We're really excited to see couples are already lining up to apply for marriage licenses, and it's going to be a fantastic day when couples, black, white, Latino, Asian American, are going to be able to apply for marriage licenses in D.C., and next week they'll actually be able to marry.
As soon as Tuesday.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. That's Michael Crawford. He's the director of New Media for Freedom to Marry. Been fighting for gay marriage rights for years. And as we said, as of today, couples can apply for marriage licenses in Washington, D.C., extending marriage rights to same-sex couples.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And a question: what's the one thing you would want the rest of the world to know about you? It's a question the BBC is asking everyone in the world to answer, and you can tell us what you want us all to know about you at 8778-MY-TAKE. We'll talk more about the BBC's competition. It's a video competition. It's very interesting in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. Let's bring you up to date on that story. It's a little amazing. I couldn't quite believe it when we did it a few minutes ago. A child allegedly allowed to talk to pilots at New York's JFK Airport using air traffic control radio transmissions. In the What Were They Thinking department, NBC News this morning is reporting that air traffic control employees are under federal investigation now for allegedly allowing a school-aged child to direct pilots waiting to take off at JFK. The FAA said the child was brought to the control tower by a parent who is an air traffic controller. The controller, as you might imagine, has been relieved of his duties.
Oh, really?
What were they thinking? President Obama will unveil his revised health care proposal today. It's expected to embrace a handful of Republican ideas. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president is still hoping for some GOP support.
The president's still hopeful that he can get 61 votes, that there could be some hope for some bipartisanship as we go forward, and I wish him well with that.
Dripping with enthusiasm there. And staying with politics, some Democrats want the White House to suspend a stimulus program that finances renewable energy. They say the program is creating jobs outside of the United States, not here in the U.S.
Texans flooded polls yesterday to cast their ballots in the Republican and Democratic primaries for governor. After a heated race, U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison lost the Republican nomination to incumbent Rick Perry, and former Houston Mayor Bill White won for the Democrats. Joining us now, Ben Philpott, who's covering the governor's race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
So how close was the race last night?
Not close at all, which is really amazing considering that last summer some polls had, or early polls, had Senator Hutchison, you know, a 10 to 20-point leader over Governor Perry. But then the campaign started, at least for Governor Perry. A lot of people think that Senator Hutchison was a little slow to kick off her own response to what Governor Perry was doing, and you know, by the first of the year, it was all over.
But people are now saying that this could signal trouble for all incumbents in the upcoming fall elections because they feel like Kay Bailey Hutchison just really suffered and may have lost this election because of the bad feelings towards Congress.
And if there is an opponent out there against any incumbent member of Congress who is able to say, look, it's our state versus the federal government, and you should vote for someone with your state to go up and make change in Washington, then they should be worried.
Okay, Ben Philpott is covering the governor's race in Texas for KUT News and the Texas Tribune. Thanks so much, Ben. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Back in 1977, Planet Earth sent a message to the universe that included this music and some other music on the Voyager spacecraft.
No one asked the Earth to do this, but it was a nice idea. And perhaps it was part of the motivation for our partner over at the BBC to launch a video competition called My World. Basically, a video message from Planet You to the whole world. What story would you tell in a two-minute video to the whole world? Each video entry is 2 minutes. Take on a topic, a person, a sentiment. Entries have come in from all over the world to the BBC, capturing stories through the eyes of independent and sometimes amateur filmmakers. The contest was designed as an innovative way to show the world stories through the eyes of those who live it. And, of course, in the Internet age, with rich media and high bandwidth, we can all see these stories and share them as well. Joining us now, Simon Pitts, who is in charge of the My World project at the BBC, joining us from Bush House in London. Good morning, Simon.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
What a great idea.
Hey, thanks a lot. Yeah, well, it's very popular.
And you're sort of awash in all kinds of amateur video now, right?
Well, I mean, we're getting a real spread of stuff, you know, from Montevideo, from Uruguay, from Nepal, from Burma. I mean, there's a really incredible reach, and of course, from the U.S.
And, of course, it's these moments like this that I get so jealous of you guys over at the Beeb, because you just flick a switch, and it comes in on all spigots from all over the world, including from Ron Guerin, who's an actor from Los Angeles. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
You submitted a two-minute video, right?
I did, sir.
And we're going to play a clip from it in a moment, along with Matomi Senyolo, who's a 29-year-old from Johannesburg in Alexandra Township. Matomi, good morning.
Morning. Afternoon, because it's afternoon this side.
Thanks for correcting me. And you sent a two-minute video about your hometown, right?
Yes, I did.
Well, let's play a clip, first of all, from Matome's... it's called Dark City. Listen carefully here.
Through the passage of life, this curse has earned itself many names. Some people call it Hamampian, while others call it Dark Seed.
The whole of the township did not have electricity. There were no lights on the streets, including in the houses. That's why the name Dark City.
Matomi Senyolo, how do you sum up a community as complex and with as much history as Alexandra Township in a two-minute video?
Oh, it's quite difficult, but I think I had to focus on the important element of the township, you know, like some of the famous aspects about it, you know, like the affection names that people call it and some of the historic moments that have taken place in Alex, basically.
Ron Guerin, what motivated you to send a film to the BBC?
I was tuning into a BBC World News broadcast and heard the advertisement for the competition and thought of my friend Charlie immediately as a subject for a short film.
And let's listen to him.
In my day, when I would be out here, I would be looking for something to rob. If I see something, a fat cash register, I'm going in there. I got to have it. They holding my money. They just don't know it. I've been in everything they got from me. Juvenile Hall, Youth Authority, State Prison.
It's Ron Guerin's film about his friend Charlie out in Los Angeles, right? You found him on the streets of Los Angeles?
That's correct.
Now, what are you trying to say in that film?
I just wanted it to be a portrait of his life and how you can find inspiration in a lot of different places. And with Charlie, he found inspiration in cultivating his relationship with or his spiritual relationship with a higher power, and he was able to change his life by doing that.
Well, you can see all these stories that we're focusing on and more by linking to thetakeaway.org. We're connected directly to the My World project at the BBC. Simon Pitts, you know, again, it just, I get so envious. The BBC says, send us your videos, and people do. What is it about the BBC where you invite and people answer?
Actually, I'm not sure if it's about the BBC. I think what it is about is that people now have the means to share their stories that they didn't have before. I mean, even 6 months ago, I'm not sure we would be running this contest. You know, using the camera on the back of your phone just opens everything up.
And, you know, it's beyond Twitter. It's full, rich media. You're seeing characters in these videos. What have you learned about the world, Simon Pitts?
Well, I think one thing that's coming out is that a lot of people are caring a lot about the internet. You know, about the environment. We've had a lot of films coming into us from specifically Canada and the United States and also Japan, where people are really focusing on their kind of backyard. It's clearly a theme that people care passionately about, and they represent it beautifully. You know, some of those films are online, and I don't know, the sort of love that, and concern that people have for the planet is really one of the strongest themes that's coming out.
And no prizes, you know. In the United States, I think you'd have to give a prize. You'd have to, you know, give somebody like the Oscar for their best My World.
Well, actually, there is a prize. I mean, there are two levels of prize, really. One is that, you know, the work will get shown on the BBC. Some of the best stuff will get shown on the BBC. And the other thing is that there's a kind of, there are curators who are arranging this material by continent, and they're going to choose the best films from each continent. Uh-huh. And one of the best films that they select will be chosen as the overall winner, and they'll get a great quality semi-pro DV HD camcorder.
Oh, well, there we go. That's fantastic. Well, Motomi Sagnolo, what's your next project?
I'm actually working on the full length of that documentary. I want to make it like 48 minutes and maybe share it with the rest of the world, basically.
Ron Guerin?
That's exactly my intention. I have so much more footage that I have of Charlie. I'm working on putting together the long version of this particular piece.
You know, Simon Pitts, we should update the Voyager spacecraft. We've created a planet of filmmakers here on Earth.
It's really interesting. Somebody, you know, we were blogging this, and somebody said, I really love what you're doing. You're creating a mosaic of humanity. And I thought that was a beautiful phrase, because actually when you see all of these people's lives in a way that we could never see them before, you really do build this kind of incredible overall impression, and the detail is amazing.
Well, I'm still envious. Simon Pitts, in charge of My World, the project at the BBC, joined us from London. Ron Guerin, an actor from Los Angeles, his film inspired by his friend Charlie, is part of the My World project. And Motomi Sagnolo, his portrait of Alexandra Township outside Johannesburg, is also part of the My World project. Thanks to all of you.
So maybe your message to the world, John, would be, I'm envious of the BBC. We're asking people for their takes on the world. You can take part in this competition, this My World competition. All you have to do is make a quick 2-minute video with any kind of camera. Tell us how you see the world. What's your message to the world? Winners are going to be shown both on television and online at the BBC's website. To get more information, visit our website, thetakeaway.org. Click on blog. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. The one thing I want you to know is I've never been convicted of a felony. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.